It's the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength conditioning and strength conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. This is episode 266, and today we're going to talk about what happens when there's too much muscle breakdown, a condition called rhabdomyolysis. Now, rhabdomyolysis is a medical condition arising from a number of different causes, all of which lead to excessive breakdown of the muscle cell and release of the contents that are normally contained within the muscle into the bloodstream. We're talking about things like potassium, phosphate, myoglobin, and calcium. These things are all released in large quantities into the bloodstream, causing serious, potentially fatal complications. In today's podcast, we'll talk about what causes rhabdomyolysis, along with how it's diagnosed, treated, and how to avoid it. And today, I'm joined by the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baraki. What's going on, dude?
Hey, man. Feeling good. I'm ready to do this thing.
All right. Well, let's start out with a clinical case to get the juices flowing. All right. So this is a 35-year-old healthy female presents to her primary care physician 24 hours after a CrossFit competition with worsening abdominal pain and swelling. Now, if I just stop right there, what do you like? If you're her PCP, you see her and that's the only thing you know about her. What's next?
Oh, boy. I mean, abdominal pain and swelling, taking that at face value, there's already a lengthy list. Now, knowing that this is an acute presentation of this narrows it quite a bit. And then after exercise in a previously healthy person, then, of course, the topic of today's podcast is something that comes to mind. If there's bleeding going on, if there was like an undiagnosed, you know, pregnancy and an unknown and the complication from that. There's just a long list of possible things that could be coming up in this scenario.
There's a 0% chance that she walks out of your office without getting a pregnancy test. 0%. There's just absolutely no way. But in any case, this woman in particular, we'll move down the case. We'll see what you say. She's 5'1", 132 pounds, and she's been training for about 5 years, 4 to 5 times per week. She has a back squat, one rep max of 315 pounds. She front squats 275 pounds, which is probably the most impressive thing here. She cleans 215 and she snatches 140. Now, the CrossFit competition consisted of 5 workouts over 2 days. Workout one was 21-15-9. That's 21 reps, 15 reps, 9 reps of chest to bar pull-ups and thrusters at 88 pounds. I think that's heavy Fran or like Fran on steroids, because Fran is normally what, 21-15-9, just regular pull-ups and thrusters.
65 for men and women, right?
So yeah, so it's got to be heavy
for the women here, a little heavier, sure.
A little heavier, a little harder with the chest to bar pull-ups. So that's workout one, which is in the afternoon on day one. In the evening on day one, they do workout two, 60 glute ham developer sit-ups, followed by 15 toes to bar.
That's
which
what
to me, to me, it's like 60 glute ham developer sit-ups. And then at the end, you're like, oh yeah, by the way, do 15 toes to bar,
yeah,
just in case.
Yeah. That's okay. The session that did it.
Yeah. And then I believe workout three was at the end of the first day of competition. It's, hey, oh, after all of that, do a one rep max snatch and an overhead squat. So just like work up, I assume build to a 1RM snatch and overhead squat. On day two, they started it out with a 5-minute AMRAP, so as many reps as possible of strict handstand pushups, which, okay, it's fine. And then workout five was 40 deadlifts at 100 pounds, 20 kettlebell clean and jerks at 55 pounds, and then 5 bar muscle ups. I assumed it's just for time altogether. Now, to me, honestly, the series of workouts, I don't know. Do you think you could make it through that without some sort of untoward outcome?
I think I can make it through all of that. However, since I do not at all train glute ham developer sit-ups, which, as we've said, are actually quite common as a cause of like pretty debilitating abdominal soreness for a lot of people who get into them. Like when I'm working with people who want to incorporate them, that's something that I introduce extremely gradually. Like you might do like a total of 5 in your first session, if you can even do that. And so that's the session that I think, even for me, because I don't do that movement ever, I'd be pretty smoked by that second workout. But the rest, yes, the rest are all fine.
You know, it's funny. I did my first CrossFit level one. I think it was like, it was either 2009 or 2010. I mean, it was way back then. And they teach you, I'm putting this in air quotes, you guys can't see this, but they teach you, we're being charitable with the term teach, how to do glute ham developer sit-ups. And at the end of this sort of teaching lesson, they're like, now be careful with these because we've heard multiple reports of people getting rhabdomyolysis in their abs. We call it abdo. And then everyone goes, chuckles. And if you recall, when we went to the CrossFit level one medical provider cert in 2018, it was the same thing. Yeah. They literally the exact same thing. It's like almost verbatim. It's like they wrote it down like a script. And it's
they're all automatons teaching that class, I think.
if you know that this particular exercise is very, in general, people are unaccustomed to it. And presents such a risk that kind of, you know, I don't know that I would be joking about that, like abdo, or because rhabdomyolysis, and particularly in vulnerable individuals, could be well,
extremely
fatal.
Serious. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll talk about that here shortly. All right. So let's keep going on with the case here now.
And just to clarify, the reason why you went into this great level of specific details, because this is a real case. This is a real case report that you're.
This is real.
That you're telling us here. Okay. Yeah. Just real. Checking.
Yeah. Then it was reported in 2018. So, yeah. And again, I think when people think about rhabdo, and if first thing goes to CrossFit, they're like, oh yeah, CrossFit games, you know, 20 different workouts or whatever over 4 or 5 days, this massive sort of energy expenditure, long workouts, whatever. Like, none of these workouts probably lasted longer than 10 minutes. Yeah. I don't think, you know? Mm-hmm. And so really that's maybe an hour of actual working out over 2 days. And I'm like, okay, maybe not so bad. But in any case, day one, she presented to her primary care physician 24 hours after the last workout. Her creatine kinase, her CK level, was 43,322 units per liter. Now, if you're not familiar with CK, this is effectively an enzyme contained in the muscle, helps with energy creation, and its normal value is 26 to 140. Now, if you saw that, if for whatever reason you drew a CK level on this person because of the potential, well, maybe an exertion related sort of issue, and you saw 43,000, what goes off in your head?
Yeah, I mean, that lab in isolation leads me to just have questions about, as usual with all tests, the context in which it was drawn, what's going on with the person, are they reporting symptoms, et cetera. And so in this patient who's having muscle pain, who's having muscle swelling, who's having a CK level this elevated, this is somebody who needs to go to the hospital.
Yeah, it was kind of weird because so she presumably went to her PCP one day after and be like, hey, what did you do this weekend? You know, you said you have abdominal pain and maybe some muscle swelling or whatever. What were you doing? And she goes, it was an exercise competition. And even if the doctor was unaware of like what CrossFit is, he or she gets a CK level and it's 43,000. And instead of being like, dang, that's high, we should maybe like evaluate you further or go to the hospital, he's like, he or she is like, you know what? Take this NSAID. And go home and drink plenty of water. What do you think about that?
Yeah, my guess in this context is because she went to a clinic, and the way practice flow goes in an outpatient clinical setting is a bit different than an ER in hospital. I'm very spoiled in that I can order a CK level and have it done in like an hour if I want to in the hospital. If you go to a clinic, you know, he would have seen her and said, well, I need you to go to the lab and get these drawn. And so she would have probably gone to the lab, gotten it drawn. And then, you know, outpatient labs are not always processed at the same kind of breakneck speed as I can get them done in the hospital. So maybe that was late in the day. He didn't see the result until the next morning. He has to do something with her that day. So he sent her home. And, you know, if he didn't have a high suspicion for rhabdo, then telling her to do that on its face might have been reasonable. But as soon as he got that number result in his EMR inbox, that should have resulted in a phone call and telling her to go to the hospital.
Yeah, I assume the lab who ran it was like, yo, this is high. And they like either like paged the doc, sent him an electronic message through the EMR, as you said, the electronic medical record, and that was flagged. Because, yo, this is either high and like spurious or like high and dangerous. You need to be aware either way. So in any case, sent home with an NSAID, told to drink plenty of water, which I think is okay with the water, but I don't know that I would send her home. 3 days later, her pain and muscle swelling were unchanged. So she went to the emergency room. At the time, her CK level was now 77,690 units per liter. Again, the normal range is 26 to 140, but she had normal kidney function based on the labs that were drawn. So effectively, all of her electrolyte levels were normal. Her creatinine level was normal, but the CK level was through the roof. Additionally, her liver function tests, ALT and AST, were elevated to 74 and 477. The normal value is less than 33 for both, which is not unusual because we know that exercise, even like light or moderate exercise, will elevate ALT and AST for days after exercise. So like if you were getting your labs done, as my dad says, I'm getting my lab's done, and you really want the chart to look nice, you shouldn't exercise for a few days before the lab. But on the other hand, I don't know that I would hold off on training just to like buff the chart. The only time I might do that is like if somebody has like a known concern for like liver, you know, function abnormalities or something, in which case you really just want to get a good sense on like, how's the liver working? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree with that in general. If I'm evaluating somebody and I'm worried about, I don't know, some kind of liver injury from a contaminated supplement or hepatitis or alcohol issues or something like that, and there happens to be exercise in the mix, which is, let's say, relatively uncommon scenario to run into, where these same folks are like hard training, but it certainly can happen, especially with the supplement concerns. Excuse me. And that would be a situation where I wouldn't want it to be confounded by like high intensity exercise. I think that in most like pretty well-trained people, that these enzymes don't probably get terribly high. I'd be curious. I've never gotten mine checked, you know, with close proximity to training. I don't actually know that I've gotten them checked at all because I haven't had a reason to. But I don't think that they would get terribly elevated in like a well-trained individual. In this case scenario, I mean, hers are 74 and 477. I would actually, you know, based on my experience seeing a lot of rhabdo over the years, I'm surprised they're not higher given that her CK was over 77,000. I would, you know, I've seen, you know, AST and ALT getting into the several thousands, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, looking like pretty scary until you realize that it's due to rhabdo and not because they're in like, you know, acute liver failure or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I was like, why are they low? Like, is something else going on? Like, that's causing a spuriously low liver function test. But in any case, so this person's now in the emergency room. You get paged. Oh, Dr. Baraki, we have a person down here with, just kidding. Okay. So what do you do in this particular situation?
Yeah. I mean, the immediate concern is looking at those labs to make sure that, you know, see what's going on with the patient's kidneys, see what's going on with their potassium levels are probably like the most immediate upfront concerns that I have. And then glancing over everything else and then going and seeing the person and getting them admitted to the hospital and started on treatment. I mean, this is somebody who definitively, you know, would meet criteria to get admitted and treated as an inpatient. This is not something that should be managed at home.
Yeah. So subsequently, that's what happened. She was admitted, given a ton of fluids, and effectively discharged from the hospital 4 days later. She was advised to avoid intense exercise in the outpatient setting. There was a follow-up exam that revealed her serum CK level was still elevated to over 3,000 10 days after the competition, and it was 1,200 on the 25th day after the competition. And so you're thinking about it like that. Like, imagine she went in for like her yearly labs. We'll just say that she's doing that, and it was a month after this competition and her CK was 1200. Again, if you were her PCP, your primary care physician in the outpatient setting, and you did not know about this exercise competition a month earlier, and you saw that CK level, you'd be like, dude, what? It's kind of like interesting that it stayed up for that high. And she even had muscle pain 25 days afterwards. So pretty interesting case here. I've linked that in the show notes below. That is a great segue into this podcast, which is on rhabdomyolysis. So what is rhabdomyolysis? It's a complex medical condition involving the rapid breakdown of damaged or injured muscle tissue, skeletal muscle tissue, leading to the direct release of intracellular muscle contents. Now, clinically, rhabdomyolysis is characterized by a triad. It's called a classic triad of myalgia, which is muscle pain, muscle weakness, and red to brown urine, dark urine, sometimes called cola-colored urine, due to myoglobinuria. That's just myoglobin in the urine. Interestingly, though, less than 10% of rhabdomyolysis cases have this triad, and over half of the patients do not report muscle pain or weakness, which makes you wonder, like, why is this called the classic triad if, like, nobody has it? Austin, when you've seen this, what is the most common reason why people actually come into the hospital?
Yeah, I think that the most common reason I've seen is people who have muscle discomfort and a sensation of swelling in the extremities that have been exercised and are having this issue ongoing. That's probably the most common reason. I would say next most common is that I would see would be the darkening of the urine. And I would say that in general, it's pretty relatively uncommon for me to see somebody who has neither pain nor the discolored urine and is only coming in just for sensation of weakness. And I happen to find them to have rhabdo. I can count on one hand the number of times that's happened. And when that's happened, it's actually not been due to exercise. It's been rhabdo due to other reasons, what we call non-exertional rhabdomyolysis as compared with exertional rhabdomyolysis, which is going to be the main topic that we discuss today. So typically it's the muscle pain and swelling sensation. They're like, my legs, my calves feel tight or uncomfortable, or the arms or whatever body area is most impacted, or some and or the discoloration of the urine would be the main reasons why I would see these people.
I'm just trying to put myself in her shoes, this particular case's shoes. And I'm like, muscle pain. I deal with that from time to time. Muscle soreness, muscle swelling. Hey, got a sick pump. It's just lasting for
days. Yeah, right.
And the minute I see dark colored urine, bro, I'm in the car. I'm on the way to the emergency room. So I thought for sure, like, it would just be, you know, why did you come in today? What brought you into the hospital today? Dark colored urine. But it's interesting that you think it's mostly muscle swelling and weakness and pain and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about the pathophysiology of rhabdomyolysis. So like, why does it happen? In general, rhabdomyolysis results from a specific, quote, insult to the muscle that ultimately leads to large amounts of muscle damage and subsequent breakdown. And these initial insults can include direct muscle damage from things like a crushing syndrome. So people in a car accident, for example, who get a limb wedged between, like, I don't know, the door and the steering wheel or other things that actually lead to large amounts of muscular damage due to it being crushed. Also surgery with prolonged immobilization or vascular occlusion, physical restraints, particularly for like combative individuals or people who are moving around a lot, compression of blood vessels with tourniquets. And actually, I went down a rabbit hole trying to see, like, are there any case reports of rhabdomyolysis with blood flow restriction training? And I came up empty. So blood flow restriction training is fine, apparently. Yeah. Low risk rhabdo. Burn or electrical injuries. And again, I went down the rabbit hole just trying to see, like, well, there's some interesting case reports. And yes, including some like tragic ones. Kids surrounded with electrical outlets and getting zapped. Yeah. Or as in the case we started with, prolonged strenuous physical exertion, particularly to unaccustomed events. In this case, likely the glute ham developer sit up. It was reported in the case report that this individual had not done glute ham developer sit-ups beforehand.
Yeah.
And so I think, I don't know, if I was like a quote team doc for like a bunch of CrossFit athletes and this workout like showed up in the hopper or something, I'd be like, hey, why don't you sit this one out?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. One other cause of direct muscular damage I would add to this list that you didn't mention, something that we unfortunately sometimes see is in older folks, people who have sarcopenia, which we've talked about for a long time, or who for whatever reason have limited mobility. And if they take a fall and they like live alone, they can be down on the ground for hours to days. And so I've had, you know, older folks with whatever sort of immobilizing condition and they get brought in, and maybe they were found down and they've been down for, you know, 10 hours, 12 hours, 24 hours, something like that. And we find that they have rhabdo just because the direct pressure on that muscle, and they're like not moving. And so that muscle ends up, you know, lacking sufficient blood flow, breaking down, necrosis, and rhabdomyolysis develops. So that's actually something that happens more often than you think.
Interesting. Yeah. We can also get rhabdomyolysis via muscular damage from indirect sources. So things like heat illness, which is the body's inability to tolerate and compensate for environmental heat. So every, you know, heat stroke, heat illness, that can all contribute. Hyperkinetic states, so individuals having seizures, for example. There are various types of myopathies, which are basically just inflammatory conditions of the muscle. These can be related to certain medications, different hereditary conditions, particularly those involving like glycogen metabolism, fat metabolism, things like that, infections, autoimmune diseases. There's a bunch of different myopathies. If you want to go down the rabbit hole, I implore you to do so, but try to stay off Google when you do this. Like, you can go to like StatPearls or on PubMed, and that'll give you some good resources there. Also COVID. And I know we're going to get flagged for talking about COVID on a podcast or something, so probably going to be a disclaimer or something. But COVID, for example, has been shown to cause rhabdomyolysis in a few different case reports. I don't know that that's unusual as far as like viral infections potentially causing that, but I had not previously heard of COVID actually causing or leading to exertional rhabdomyolysis. I guess it wouldn't really be exertional unless they were exercising and happen to have COVID, but in the case report, that wasn't really reported. But even things like flu, so influenza, HIV, also been associated as indirect causes of excessive muscular damage. Things like other drugs, particularly cocaine and amphetamine, stimulants in general, although caffeine, unless people are taking a ton of it, tends not to contribute, but definitely cocaine, amphetamines, other stimulant type medications or drugs. Sickle cell anemia is actually probably the most interesting thing that I had read about in preparation for this podcast. So sickle cell anemia, effectively, the red blood cells are shaped in a way that kind of looks like a sickle, apparently due to genetic disorder. And this can lead to rhabdomyolysis in some individuals. And the way that the authors describe rhabdomyolysis for individuals with sickle cell, they term it explosive sort of rhabdomyolysis. Apparently, individuals with sickle cell anemia, rhabdomyolysis syndrome can present as a conscious collapse during exercise, which is termed exertional collapse associated with sickle cell trait. ECAST is the acronym there. In these cases of exertional rhabdomyolysis complicated by sickle cell trait with collapse, there's an increased risk of serious complications like compartment syndrome, electrolyte or metabolic disturbances, heart arrhythmias, and sudden death. And in fact, one of the authors who's apparently a leading expert in sickle cell anemia and rhabdomyolysis says the only fatal cases that they've seen of rhabdomyolysis has been in individuals with sickle cell trait. Have you seen an individual with sickle cell anemia and rhabdo?
Yeah. So to distinguish, you know, sickle cell anemia is like the full blown, you know, mutation that people have leading to abnormal hemoglobin. And what you're describing here with ECAST is a sickle cell trait, which is not necessarily having the full mutation. I've seen one case of this ever. And it was, I agree, the most severe case of rhabdomyolysis that I've ever seen. It was in a 20-year-old who had sudden collapse during an exercise session. And got brought into the hospital. And so his CK levels when he showed up were greater than 100,000. That was the way the lab reported it, meaning it was just like off the upper limit. It didn't go any higher than that. Some labs can dilute and get a better calculation. But typically, once you start treating rhabdo effectively, you see a pretty, you know, quick and steady decline in the CK levels a lot of the time. Not always. Sometimes it still continues to go up before it comes down. His CK level remained just greater than 100,000 for the first like six-ish days of his admission. So it was by far the worst. He was 20 years old, didn't have any other medical problems until this happened. And then we discovered he had sickle cell trait and he ended up requiring requiring dialysis and having a very complicated kind of course in the hospital. However, what really shocked me after seeing him go through all this is followed up on him months later and found that his kidney function had nearly completely recovered back down and his creatinine got back all the way down to like 1 or 1.2 or something like that. So he was off of dialysis at that point. So it was a month-long ordeal, very complicated. Lots of other things happened in the interim, but the worst case of rhabdo I've ever seen was ECAST, this particular scenario that you're describing. Yeah.
Yeah, the conscious collapse during exercise. I'm trying to put myself in this individual's shoes. It's like you go down, you collapse, and somebody, hey, are you okay? Like, what happened? Did you black out? Did you, you know, somebody hit you in the head? Like, what's going on? It's like, no, I fell. And they're like, why? And you're like, don't know.
Yeah, pretty scary.
Yeah, for sure. In any case, after the insult to the muscle, the ion channels that normally maintain low levels of sodium and calcium and high levels of potassium within the muscle fibers no longer work appropriately. Effectively, you've damaged the cellular membrane and the ion channels that are in the cellular membrane. It's all torn to shit, all right? And this causes a massive shift of sodium and calcium into the muscle fiber, thereby causing further damage, swelling, and breakdown of the muscle, perpetuating a sort of self-sustaining muscle breakdown cycle and muscular fiber death or necrosis. Now, because the muscle is broken down so extensively, the contents that were previously inside the muscle are released into the bloodstream in mass quantities. So let's talk about them. First up is myoglobin. Now, myoglobin is an iron-containing protein that is responsible for delivering oxygen to the working muscle. And myoglobin is pretty small. It's rapidly excreted into the urine from the blood. And due to its relatively small size, it often results in the production of red to brown urine. It appears in the urine when the plasma concentration exceeds about 1.5 milligrams per deciliter and urine levels exceed approximately 100 to 300 milligrams per deciliter. Now, you guys don't need to remember those numbers, but what you need to know is that in the normal urine sample, in an individual without rhabdomyolysis, there's effectively no myoglobin in the urine. It's very, very low. Usually you can't detect any of it. You get some trace amounts here and there, but otherwise the normal level is effectively zero. And urine testing can actually pick up far lower levels. So to Austin's point, when people present with like muscle pain and weakness, potentially with swelling, but no dark colored urine, you do a urinalysis and you can pick up on myoglobin if it's there. For completeness, because people are like, myoglobin, that sounds a lot like hemoglobin. What's that? Hemoglobin is another iron-containing sort of protein capable of producing dark urine, but is much larger and requires much higher plasma concentrations, so blood concentrations, before you get a bunch of it in the urine and the urine changes colors. In any case, high levels of myoglobin in the blood can get filtered by the kidney and can cause what's known as acute kidney injury, sometimes called AKI, due to tubular obstruction. So the actual tubules in the kidneys themselves get obstructed by these iron-containing, we call them pigment casts, and you can also get tubular damage from the iron containing proteins themselves. Effectively, iron's like, yo man, what are you doing? You trying to get rid of me? I don't think so. And messes with the tubules. And so this acute kidney injury can be due to the iron containing pigment itself from the myoglobin, but also due to hypovolemia, which just low amounts of fluid volume that's normally contained within the blood itself. A substantial amount of the body's water effectively enters the damaged muscle tissue. It goes out of the blood vessels, and this is called third spacing. So effectively, you don't have enough blood going to your organs, including the kidney, and you get kidney damage. We call that AKI. AKI or acute kidney injury occurs somewhere between 15 to over 50% of folks with rhabdomyolysis, depending on the particular case. So is it exertional versus non-exertional? And the individual, do they have any existing kidney disease? Do they have other medical conditions that might make them more vulnerable? Now, Austin, when you're evaluating people and you suspect rhabdomyolysis, assume you're getting, you know, a number of lab tests, including, you know, measures of kidney function. What sort of numbers or what sort of things worry you on these blood tests when you're looking for like a kidney injury?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to get my attention anytime that the number that we use to monitor people's kidney function, usually the creatinine is the main number that we'll monitor. Anytime that's higher than what the person's usual level is, that's going to get my attention. But then the higher it is from there in terms of like multiples of their normal. So if their normal is 0.5 and they come in and it's like 0.9, okay, that's going to get my attention a little bit, but I'm not terribly concerned. If somebody's normal is 0.5 and they're coming in and they're actually at like 4.5 or something, I'm a lot more concerned. And if they come in and they're at like 10 or something, I'm extremely concerned. So it's just how many multiples of their normal starting level are they up? And just it's like a linear, if not exponential, risk in terms of level of concern, the higher it is from there.
Yeah, and with higher levels, you also expect other sort of abnormalities with respect to kidney function, various electrolytes, which we'll talk about here shortly. Okay, so that's the story, though, with myoglobin and the kidneys and this risk for acute kidney injury. We'll keep coming back to the kidneys throughout this podcast. Another abnormality you're going to see on lab testing, again, we kind of referred to it earlier in the case report, is creatine kinase. So creatine kinase is also normally stored within the muscle itself as it plays a role in energy production within muscle cells. And so we call the CK, again, that stands for creatine kinase. Now, normal levels are between 26 to 140 units per liter. But in rhabdomyolysis, serum creatine kinase or creatine kinase or CK levels can be at, you know, five times the upper limit of normal, but also much, much higher. To your point about the person with sickle cell trait, it was over 100,000, which is 100 times higher than the upper limit. And this actually leads us into a pretty interesting discussion, because when I conceptualize rhabdomyolysis, particularly exertional rhabdomyolysis, I view it on this sort of continuum, right? Where you have like delayed onset muscle soreness, DOMS, on one side of it. And on the complete other side, the more severe side, you have rhabdomyolysis. And one thing I hadn't put in there in the middle, because I wasn't too aware of it, I hadn't really delved into the research, is this other sort of, not condition, because it's, I don't want to medicalize like normal things, but an interesting finding, we'll say, we call it hyper-CKemia, so hypercreatine kinaseemia. These are people that just have really high levels of CK, for example, and maybe some myoglobin on their urinalysis, but no other signs of rhabdomyolysis. So if we go through this continuum, on the left side, the sort of benign side, if you will, you have DOMS, delayed onset muscle soreness. This is a sort of self-limited physiological response to exercise, resulting in mild to moderate muscle pain and soreness and elevations in serum muscle enzyme levels like CK. And so we think this is due to, again, muscle sort of damage, muscle protein breakdown, the inflammatory cascade, effectively being the cavalry that comes to the rescue, and muscle remodeling repair goes on. And so that's why you sort of feel that after a workout, particularly a workout with like novel exercises or more volume, or potentially in an environmentally stressful sort of a situation. So more heat, or it's very cold, or something like that. In this way, you know, rhabdo could be considered an extreme continuation of DOMS, but since the muscle damage isn't so severe with DOMS, the risk of kidney injury, electrolyte abnormalities, et cetera, are low. Effectively, the amount of muscle damage that's taken place is far, far less than what we see in rhabdo. Now, in the middle, again, this is sort of newer condition to me anyway, is called hyper-CKemia, hypercreatine kinaseemia, which is extremely high elevated levels of CK. We're talking about levels into like the 30,000, 40,000 mark with some myoglobin in the urine, but no severe muscle symptoms. So no muscle pain that's severe, no muscle weakness, no muscle swelling that's severe. And more importantly, no organ damage, no evidence of AKI, so that acute kidney injury, liver dysfunction, the electrolyte abnormalities aren't present. And so it's just like people who, in some cases, and like there's data on ultramarathoners, for example, have really high levels of CK, some myoglobin in the urine, even some hemoglobin in the urine that's from exercise as well, but no other signs or symptoms. And you're like, it kind of smells like rhabdo, but not quite there yet. And so again, it's just another point on this continuum. This has been shown also in military personnel, also Division I American football player, college football players. They have CK levels greater than 5 times the upper limit. And again, presence of myoglobin in the urine. And if you're just checking boxes, you're like, kind of smells like rhabdo, but no other signs or symptoms. And again, it's just well accepted that pretty much any type of exercise, even low to moderate intensity exercise, increases CK levels into the, you know, that you could measure. But again, I just want to sort of divorce the idea between just CK levels and sort of like badness, because it just, it happens. And in some individuals, the response is super robust. Have you ever seen, if you could recall, a case that now makes sense as being called like hyper-CKemia? Have you seen anything like that in the hospital?
Yeah, I mean, I've not seen this particular term, but as a concept, it's something I've been very well aware of, not just from, you know, clinical work, but also this is something that leads people to our forum a lot posting questions. And I think it is worth emphasizing, because for some reason, I guess a lot of the folks who come on our forum and they post and they say, you know, I had this, my CK level checked and it was this high and my doctor freaked out and told me to stop exercising or something like that. And our usual response is like, why was it checked? Did you have like signs or symptoms that would be concerning for something like rhabdo? And usually the answer is no, in which case they shouldn't have checked it at all. I guess there's some clinicians out there who, like, when they hear that their patient is exercising, they choose to add on a CK level onto their labs, which is not necessary and should not be done, because it's completely unsurprising that somebody who is active, training, particularly in close proximity to getting their labs done, the CK is going to be elevated. And if that's elevated, that does not diagnose rhabdomyolysis. This is something I see extremely commonly, both with our consultations and forum and also clinically, where, you know, somebody might have a little bit of an elevated, you know, CK level. Maybe it's like, you know, 4,000 or something, and they're in the ER, and I might get called for, is this rhabdo? And no, in that, it might not be rhabdo for that particular person, not only because of the relatively modest elevation in that lab parameter, but also maybe the patient didn't have significant symptoms that would have led me to check it in the first place. So definitely unsurprising that I just view this as like a marker for like, yep, you trained, and is not something that is diagnostic on its own in the absence of the other features that we would look for, the pain, the swelling, potentially weakness, the urinary stuff, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a number of studies that have tried to correlate, you know, CK levels to like exercise recovery or fatigue from exercise, and it doesn't correlate well at all. But I don't know if just maybe the presence of that idea in like the in academic circles maybe is just like a holdover. We're like, hey, look, CK is elevated in general, badness. Yeah, I don't know. We should just divorce that idea.
The other thing to point out is that the CK itself is not toxic or harmful. The reason, you know, this is also a misconception, is that when people get rhabdo and they get a CK checked and it's very elevated, and we want that number to come down, which I agree, that's like one of my treatment endpoints when I'm treating somebody for this, is I want that number to come down below 5,000 before I feel okay, like letting you go home. But it's not because I'm worried that the CK is toxic. It is a marker for the severity of muscle damage. And what I'm really worried about is the potential for myoglobin induced injury or like potassium derangements and things like that. So the CK is not toxic, just for the record.
You're not worried about the CK itself. You're worried about why it's elevated and what it's contributing to otherwise. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. And speaking to that, there are other components that were with inside the muscle. So things like potassium, phosphate, calcium. These things are also released, which can cause electrolyte abnormalities, which can lead to a number of different worrisome problems. So such as hyperkalemia, which is high or elevated level of potassium. So potassium, a lot of your body's potassium stores are within the muscle. And in fact, in previous studies on like body composition changes, muscle mass changes over time, they used total body potassium as like a way to measure total body muscle mass changes. But in any case, Austin, if somebody's potassium level is through the roof, you saw hyperkalemia, or you got a lab sort of notification, yo, your potassium's super high, like you're worried about arrhythmias, you're worried about other sort of organ dysfunction just due to the high potassium levels, yeah?
Yeah, if I believe that lab draw is giving me an accurate result, then that is an absolute emergency.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, got to get the potassium level back to normal. And so, yeah, it's no surprise that in some severe cases of rhabdomyolysis, again, generally not exertional rhabdomyolysis, so like from excessive exercise, you do run the risk of arrhythmia, so an abnormal heart rhythm, and sudden cardiac arrest. Other electrolyte abnormalities that are seen with rhabdomyolysis are hyperphosphatemia, because phosphate's usually contained in the muscle as well, and so that's released into the bloodstream. Hypocalcemia can also occur, as calcium is sort of sequestered into the damaged necrotic muscle tissue, and there's also a reduced parathyroid hormone response in bone Interestingly, I found that there was like an increase in calcitriol, which is like a subtype of vitamin D in the, you know, making of active vitamin D pathway. And it can cause this mild secondary hyperparathyroidism. I didn't find much data on like parathyroid levels throughout the course of rhabdomyolysis, but I just thought it was interesting. I don't know if you've ever seen some abnormal parathyroid endocrine activity and were like shrugged your shoulders. But now, if you saw that with
rhabdomyolysis. I've definitely seen calcium swings in the recovery phase of rhabdo, calcium that can swing abnormally high. And that's just something that we know how to manage too. But that's expected in severe cases.
Yeah. The last sort of complication that we do get worried about is called compartment syndrome. So effectively, when you're administering, one of the treatments for rhabdomyolysis is administration of fluids. And we'll talk about that here after the break. But when people are given fluids, particularly high amounts of fluids, potentially, if there's a closed space, so blood flow is not as it should be, you can get increased pressure. And if this happens in a limb, for example, and you're more fluids going in than it's coming out and it stays there, you can get a bunch of pressure buildup and it can compress arteries, veins, nerves, et cetera, ultimately leading to greater amounts of muscle death. And this is an emergency. Have you ever seen compartment syndrome from rhabdo?
Yes.
from exertional
and from other things, exertional related complications with this that needed like fasciotomies and things like that, where they needed to fillet the person's limb open to relieve the pressure, which is pretty gnarly.
Yeah, I actually was evaluated for elective fasciotomy. I don't know if you know that. Did I ever tell you the story?
I think you might have told me before. Is this for like a supposed exertional compartment syndrome type of concern?
Yeah, so there's this condition, we call it arm pump in motocross racing. And so in general, some people get it very frequently and other people never get it at all, regardless of like cardiorespiratory fitness. Effectively, the forearms pump up to a point where you have no more fine motor control of your hands, which on a moving vehicle is general badness. You can't control the throttle. You can't grab the front brake, the clutch, or whatever. Your hands are effectively numb and it hurts. And so what do? You either stop riding or you just send it and hope for the best. A number of professional motocross racers have gotten elective fasciotomies in order to basically relieve the pressure in their forearms. There's like four small incisions for all four compartments of the forearms. Interestingly, though, there's like a pretty high failure rate for these procedures where the fascial tissue actually scars down and it gets worse than it was to begin with. But some people have had successful fasciotomies. Okay. Right after this break, we'll talk about the incidence of rhabdomyolysis, the diagnosis of it, and the treatment. We'll be back right after this. This podcast is brought to you by Pioneer Belts. At Pioneer Belts, they have belts for all applications. If you're interested on how belts work or how to choose a belt, check out our podcast episode number 219. Most people will do best with a 4-inch wide belt that's 10 millimeters thick, either single prong or lever, depending on the fastening mechanism that you prefer. Pioneer has industry-exclusive micro-adjustments on their lever belts for ease of use without tools. They also make custom belts to your specs, depending on what you want. Trusted by some of the world's strongest athletes, choose Pioneer for your weightlifting belts and accessories. Head to generalleathercraft.com and tell them Barbell Medicine sent you.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, we're back here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast, episode 266 with Dr. Austin Baracchi. We're talking about rhabdomyolysis. All right, let's talk about the incidence here. Now, unfortunately, there's no really good data on incidence of rhabdomyolysis with exercise or sports participation in general. We just don't really know, like, how often does this happen with, like, people who work out? How often do they get exertional rhabdomyolysis? However, there are a number of known risk factors, some of which we've already discussed. So certain medications like amphetamines, other stimulants, even antihistamines, certain antipsychotics, alcohol, statins even. Austin, have you seen statin-induced rhabdomyolysis?
It is exceedingly rare, but the only types of people who are going to see it are people like me working in a hospital setting. So yes.
Yeah, fair enough. Also dietary supplements, particularly those containing stimulants, we don't think caffeine, again, is a strong contributor to rhabdomyolysis, but other stimulants, synephrine, for example, or others, or banned stimulants that have made their way into various pre-workouts can increase the risk of exertional rhabdomyolysis. Extremes in the environment, so high or low temperature, very high humidity, training at altitude, particularly for individuals with like altitude sickness, sickle cell trait, other sorts of things like that. I found a pretty good data set on sort of cultures with what are called extreme leadership. So effectively in situations like an athletic department, in the military, for example, or even gyms that have place an excessive emphasis on winning at all costs and this sort of idea that doing more training, more work will necessarily lead to better performance, perhaps, you know, with excessive risk tolerance, that's going to increase the sort of risk of rhabdomyolysis. And those are all extrinsic sort of causes. Now, intrinsically, there are medical conditions. So individuals with infection, individuals who are dehydrated, individuals who have hypo or hyperthermia, or have history of heat stroke, for example, a number of genetic, metabolic, or autoimmune disorders, previously subclinical in particular. So people don't know that they have them. And then they go do like a really hard workout or, you know, I just imagine somebody on like a, you know, I'm especially at the new year, like I'm going to do like a, you know, go ruck challenge or something, or like some ultra endurance event. And then it's like, oh, it turns out you had a glycogen storage disease. And so you're at risk for actual rhabdomyolysis. Sickle cell trait, as we mentioned before, being deconditioned, especially in the setting of like rapidly accelerated physical training. And also, again, this high motivation or drive to persist. And this is pretty common in military trainees and other athletes, for example. And so that's kind of like the perfect storm. If I was trying to work up like a specific scenario where I thought rhabdomyolysis risk would be elevated, it'd be like a person who was previously really well trained, highly motivated in an environment where, you know, failure is not an option or quitting is not an option, or they perceive that it's not an option, and they're just sending it over and over and over and over again. It's like, yeah, particularly if you're not well trained, that seems to be particularly risky. And oh yeah, and it's hot outside, and by the way, you're not used to any of this exercise, so good luck.
Yeah, this reminded me of a case that I saw back in residency years ago of a guy who was, I think he might have been like in his 30s or something like that, and he was not super well trained and decided to apply for the police academy. And so he was going through the training program for that with, I presume, a coaching organization who was, you know, built to prepare him for that. And this was in South Texas, where I was at the time. So warm. Their training for that day was in like a garage kind of setup, warehouse sort of thing, where they closed the garage doors. They turned off the fans. They were not allowed to have water because you have to be hardcore for this job, I guess. And what he did for his session was basically 30-minute AMRAP bodyweight squat, as many bodyweight squat reps as he could continuously for 30 minutes. And he ended up getting rhabdo. I remember his CK. I have a weird memory for these things. I think it peaked at like 48,000 or something, which was actually not as high as I expected it to be after that sort of thing. But yeah, he ended up being stuck in the hospital for days until that resolved. He had a particularly rough course too. So basically all of the features that many of the features you described here were present in this dude. But in general, for the folks listening, it's like, it's given that you laid out earlier this spectrum from DOMS to rhabdo, if you consider the risk factors for DOMS and you turn those up to 11, then that's what can lead you to develop rhabdo, as well as these other extrinsic sorts of things. So if you think about, you know, doing way more than you're prepared for on something new, with or without other underlying risk factors or something like that, that's how you end up with rhabdo.
Yeah. All right, so let's move on to signs and symptoms of rhabdomyolysis. We've covered a few of these, but we'll discuss them in more detail. So muscle pain is very common, and muscle pain when present is typically most prominent in the muscle groups that were like worked during the exertional sort of task, commonly in the thighs, shoulders, low back, calves. Other muscle symptoms include stiffness and cramping. But again, these can occur anywhere, like our initial case. The abdominal region, abdomyolysis, if you will. Muscle weakness is also common, depending on how severe the muscle injury was or muscular damage was. And again, it usually occurs in the same muscle groups that were affected with pain and swelling that were active during the exertional task. I guess there's no such thing as like a referred rhabdomyolysis. Like it's not going elsewhere. Okay. As far as the muscle swelling goes, it generally develops with fluid repletion, or maybe gets worse with fluid repletion. So once you start giving the people fluids, the swelling is a little bit worse. Less common, though, upon a hospital admission. And there's two main flavors of swelling. One is called myoedema. This is non-pitting, which means if you press on it, the fingerprint doesn't stay. This occurs after rehydration, and that's usually in the muscles themselves that were sort of affected. And there's also peripheral edema, which is like in the ankles, for example, and it's pitting. So when you press on it, the fingerprint kind of stays. And this occurs with rehydration again, but most likely in individuals with that kidney injury. Effectively, the kidneys aren't working as well to handle all that additional fluid, and the fluid's got to go somewhere. So it just sits in your lower legs, for example. No more ankles for you for a period of time. Again, the urine is dark. This is also often referred to as a classic sign, but is present in relatively few cases. And in other causes of rhabdomyolysis, for example, people with heat illness or people with infection or whatever, you can get systemic sort of symptoms. So general feelings of badness, what academics call malaise. You can have fever, tachycardia, rapid heart rate, nausea and vomiting, and again, abdominal pain. Now, our case report here did have abdominal pain, but it wasn't from like the systemic sort of issue. Is just due to the glutam developer sit-ups. You know what? We could also say it's from the toes to bar, because maybe she was just fine with the 60 glutam developer sit-ups. It was the 15 toes to bar that put her over the top. But again, these systemic sort of findings are usually not from exertional type causes of rhabdomyolysis. All right. So let's talk about diagnosis. So how do you actually diagnose rhabdomyolysis? So the first thing is this history. So like what was going on, particularly if it's exertional rhabdomyolysis, there needs to be some sort of like physical task or challenge that was recently completed. And then the next step on is moving to a urinalysis. Now, urinalysis is a fancy way of saying we do a urine collection and then test it. Usually you're looking for a positive heme. This effectively means that there's iron in the urinalysis, but no red blood cells. So it's not actually blood. So you're like, I got iron, but no red blood cells. Where else could it come from? Oh, maybe it's myoglobin. Unfortunately, this myoglobin, this positive heme test of the urine, is not detected in over 65% of patients. And this is because myoglobin has a rapid half-life, about 2 to 3 hours, which is much shorter than CK's half-life. That's 36 hours. So this dark or cola-colored urine in an athlete is like an early sign of exertional rhabdomyolysis, or it can be caused by several other conditions, some serious and some trivial. And I feel like it's a good time to actually talk about those. So in general, dark urine in an athlete deserves prompt evaluation. If your urine looks funky, you should probably see a doctor about that. In cases of rhabdomyolysis, the urinalysis, again, will be positive for heme, but no actual red blood cells. And again, these things peak tending to be 12 to 24 hours before CK levels, again, because the half-life is relatively short. Other subtypes of patients that have dark urine and a positive urinalysis for blood, but not just heme without blood, these people can have metabolic myopathies. So they have dark urine, but they typically have little to no muscle pain. And when a metabolic myopathy is suspected, you basically get an auto consult for a specialist. You usually call neurology for that, somebody with like a history of this, or who do you call?
These people don't really make it to me. This is stuff that gets figured out in pediatric populations, because you'll have kids that end up getting rhabdo over and over and over again, like early in life with relatively little provocation.
Got it.
So okay. Not my territory. Yeah.
Fair enough. Hematuria, which is a fancy way of saying actual red blood cells in the urine, or hemoglobinuria, may present also with dark colored urine. And you can get some of this with intense, prolonged exercise, but it rarely leads to actually dark colored urine. But if someone's got blood, actual blood in the urine, there's a whole nother differential diagnosis for why somebody has blood in the urine. But rhabdomyolysis is not one of those causes. But in any case, if your urine looks funky, particularly if it's dark, that probably should prompt a call to your doctor for an evaluation.
Yeah, especially if there's not an immediately obvious like reason of, oh, it's transiently darker than usual and I haven't drank anything all day. But as soon as you chug some water, it clears up. Like, you don't need to go to a doctor for that. Or, oh, I ate a bunch of beets and so my urine's like funky, you know, darker colored. That's actually quite common, although can be interestingly associated with underlying iron deficiency in some people, but not always. But those are relatively benign things that should clear up quickly. If you have it and it's not otherwise explained, or it's not clearing up or something, then yeah, I agree.
Yep. Okay. So that's the story on the urinalysis part of the diagnosis of rhabdomyolysis. Second, next part after the history, the urinalysis is a serum CK. Again, that's creatine kinase. So serum CK levels at presentation of rhabdomyolysis are usually at least 5 times the upper limit of normal. And just as a reminder, the upper limit of normal is like 140 units per liter. And so 5 times is really nothing. I mean, we're talking about like a level of like 600 or 700. And I bet you if we tested our CK levels after training, I would imagine that regularly our CK levels are 5 times the upper limit of normal. Do you think that's true?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't bat an eye at a level of 500 or something like that in the vast majority of situations.
So. Yeah. But most of the time in exertional rhabdomyolysis, we're thinking about ranges in 1500 on the low level to over 100,000, although that'd be more consistent with like a sickle cell trait or somebody with a really high level for other reasons. But in a series of 475 hospitalized patients with rhabdomyolysis, the mean peak creatine kinase level for a variety of different causes and for patients with both single and multiple causes of rhabdomyolysis range from 10,000 to 25,000 units per liter, which again is not as impressive as our case report. She was up at 77,000, which is impressive. I also, what do you think is more concerning for a doctor to say to you? Oh, that's interesting. what did I just say with the eye?
They're impressive. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think is it impressive? Those are pretty synonymous, I think, in my opinion. I use both frequently.
Yeah, to be like, wow. All right. So the serum CK, as we mentioned earlier, begins to rise within 2 to 12 hours following the onset of this sort of muscular damage and usually reaches its max level within 24 to 72 hours, but not always. A decline is usually seen within 3 to 5 days of the cessation of whatever is causing the muscle injury, but again, not always. Creatine kinase, again, has a serum half-life of approximately 1.5 days, about 36 hours, and declines at a relatively constant rate of approximately 40 to 50% of the previous day's value. I remember during intern year, I had a couple cases of rhabdo, and like we always expect like, oh yeah, the value should half by tomorrow if we reach the peak. But if it didn't reach the peak, it's going to go higher. And once we reach the peak, it should go down by half day by day. Now, in patients whose CK levels do not decline as expected, ongoing muscle injury or an underlying muscle disease or the development of compartment syndrome may be present. Have you ever seen anything like this where somebody's CK level just keeps going up?
Not usually. Well, so it's pretty common for it to sometimes trend upward, particularly if they came in very soon after their exercise bout with symptoms, then it might go up for a bit before it starts to turn around. What I have seen getting at this point, though, is situations where they came in and it looked like rhabdo and I'm treating them and then it comes down and down and down and then it plateaus. I remember one woman in particular who I was treating for what seemed to be rhabdo from a, you know, excessive exertion around the house, and it came down and it just stopped going down at 9,000. And when it got to 9,000 and then the next day it was 9,000, and I was like, this is not normal. And so we ended up diagnosing her with an underlying muscle disease called polymyositis that kind of predisposed her to developing the exertional rhabdomyolysis on top of her muscle disease. So I've definitely seen all of these scenarios play out before.
Yeah. Now, again, the widely accepted sort of diagnostic threshold for creatine kinase in exertional rhabdomyolysis is greater than 5 times the upper limit of normal. It's very sensitive, meaning that if you use this cutoff, you're going to catch everybody who has rhabdomyolysis, but it's not very specific, meaning that you're going to get a lot of false positives. You're like, oh, wow, it's elevated. Maybe you have rhabdo, and most of these people probably don't. For example, in a prospective study of about 500 different Army recruits in basic training, the CK level on day 7 of activity averaged 1,220 units per liter with a range of 56, which is normal, to over 35,000, which is decidedly abnormal. That might be like a hyper-CKemia, for example. But none had any clinical symptoms consistent with exertional rhabdo or required treatment. All of this is to say that CK levels will vary based on individuals, based on their fitness levels, based on age, gender, size, all sorts of stuff, and that there's really no accepted sort of threshold for like, oh, the CK level definitively means exertional rhabdomyolysis unless it's very, very high and otherwise not useful anymore. Like if somebody said the CK level of over 100,000 was diagnostic for exertional rhabdomyolysis, you're like, yeah, probably, but who cares? If it's over 100,000, you got bigger fish to fry, yeah. You know? There are additional labs that we think are useful. So for example, a complete blood count to see if somebody has an infection or if they're hemolyzing or actually breaking down red blood cells. There are others, obviously, depending on the individual's personal medical history and like what's going on. We also think getting a complete metabolic panel to assess kidney function and also liver function would be useful. Particularly, you're looking for like calcium and phosphate ions, and also what's their creatinine level. Because when the labs show that a person has kidney injury, which is defined by the improving global outcomes criteria from KDIGO as an increase in serum creatinine by 0.3 milligrams per deciliter, or a serum creatinine greater than 1.5 times somebody's baseline level, or a really low urinary output. So effectively, somebody has an AKI based on any of these criteria. Effectively, that warrants admission to the hospital for inpatient management, which begs a question, Austin, like, why is it important for somebody who has acute kidney injury based on their labs? Why is it important that they're actually admitted to the hospital?
Yeah, the first is that it's treatable, and by treating it, and you know, we even admit people who do not have a acute kidney injury but who meet criteria for significant rhabdomyolysis in order to try to prevent them from developing acute kidney injury for multiple reasons. We've mentioned and alluded to some of the potential short-term life-threatening complications, like from elevated potassium levels and things like that. The other more longer term is that severe acute kidney injury can increase the risk of developing chronic kidney disease in the long term. And chronic kidney disease, especially if it progresses to more advanced end-stage kidney disease, is something that can land people on dialysis or potentially make them need a kidney transplantation. And I'm certainly not saying that it's very common that patients are developing rhabdomyolysis and end up with a kidney transplant as a result. But we view your kidney's function, ability to filter your blood, it's something that most people take for granted, way too much for granted, until you realize what life is like when you are not able to do that for yourself and you need a dialysis machine to do it, or you need a transplanted kidney to do it for you. So pretty significant complications can arise, and it's both treatable if it does develop and preventable if it hasn't developed yet, but you still meet criteria for hospitalization for rhabdomyolysis.
Yeah. And in addition to that sort of complete metabolic panel, also drawing calcium and phosphate levels, because while these are known to correlate with exertional rhabdomyolysis severity, also can, in addition to potassium levels, can be a risk for arrhythmias. So you're getting EKGs on everybody that you think might have rhabdomyolysis?
Yeah, I mean, usually it's already done for me by the ER, but if they haven't done it, then it's something I'm usually taking a peek at for sure.
Are you guys doing any serial EKGs, like over time, or you just do one and done, and if somebody has symptoms, you'll do it again?
Yeah, I would only do it up front, and if it's abnormal up front, then I might do it again, or if they have ongoing electrolyte issues, but I'm not just doing them around the clock for the sake of it.
Yeah, EKG. All right, so what is the normal clinical course for patients that you've seen with rhabdo? Now, understanding there's this many different causes, and so patients will present with different sort of features, different types of rhabdo. What is the, in general, normal clinical course for somebody with the exertional rhabdomyolysis?
Yeah, so I'll frame this through the lens that, you, as usual, I have a bit of selection bias in terms of the context in which I work. And so I would say the vast majority of people who have some muscle pain after exercise, they have delayed onset muscle soreness and it's fine. And they can just go about their life and, either continue doing that if they enjoy it or adjust their programming to not experience that again. If you do develop a little bit more severe injury, I suspect that there's probably to your point of that we don't have data on incidence, I suspect that there's a fair amount of people who actually develop a little mild touch of the rhabdo and never seek out care. And they end up, just living their life and they end up recovering and they end up doing okay. So that's probably another pretty large swath, if I had to guess. I wonder how close we've ever come. If any of our training history, we might've met criteria for rhabdo, just never sought out care or something like that. And then there's going to be people who end up coming to the ER, and a fair amount of people who come to the ER, I never meet them because maybe they get a liter or two of fluid and their actually levels are already going down and they don't look terribly bad and they can get sent home safely. So that's another big swath. And then from there, we have a fraction of people who end up needing my attention, needing to get admitted to the hospital. And most of those people that I see do fine. I admit them, I'll give them some fluids. Sometimes within a day or two, they're already better. Sometimes they need several days, sometimes a week. That's on the longer side for most of the people that I might see. And the most unlucky would be needing to stay in the hospital for longer than that, usually due to complications like needing dialysis or needing to be in an ICU or something like that. And that's the tiniest fraction of people. So I would say that overall, in my little section of this whole spectrum, of the people who I see who end up needing to be hospitalized for it, the vast majority do totally fine with supportive care, with plenty of fluids, good attention to their blood tests and things like that. They end up, you know, recovering, getting through it without actually experiencing significant kidney injury, and they can go about their life. And I usually, you know, have a talk with them before they leave, where I review how they got to that point and talk to them about their return to activity, because usually they're pretty concerned about that. I'm sure we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this is a good segue into the treatment for rhabdomyolysis. We've mentioned fluids all the time. And so I was really hopeful to come up with some sort of consensus statement or like clinical practice guidelines on like what fluids to use and like how much to give. And unfortunately, that just doesn't exist. I mean, there's a guideline from the International Society of Nephrology Renal Disaster Relief Task Force, which sounds super official. And they just recommend using isotonic saline rather than alkaline fluids in the field. And I'm like, wait, no alkaline water. Oh, that's going to be a big bummer for some of these grifters in this space. But is there any particular type of fluid that you use, or any particular type, like rate that you you give people fluids?
Yeah, I mean, I think only internal medicine people and nephrologists are the folks who really nerd out about this stuff. And there are various like theoretical reasons why one fluid may be better than another, but they've not been really studied too much. And so most of the time I'm using saline, and rarely I'm using other stuff. And then, yeah, similar. It's really like, The goal of treating the IV fluids is to generate a sufficient rate of urine output. And so I will just do what needs to be done in order to generate that urine output. And then there is also a bunch of other considerations for like how fast or slow and frequency of monitoring and things like that. So
yeah, there was some data I found where people were advocating for including some glucose in the infusion to like, if somebody was particularly hyperkalemic and you were treating that alongside of the exertional rhabdomyolysis, like, oh, you put a little glucose in there, that can help with the hyperkalemia. And it's like, cool, where are your outcome studies? And it's like, no, that doesn't exist. So I don't know. Again, like you said, internal medicine docs and nephrologists are the only ones nerding out about this, way above my pay grade. So
yeah,
can't relate. And I assume that when people are admitted, you know, it seems like, yeah, you'd want to figure out like, why do they get exertional rhabdomyolysis or rhabdomyolysis in general? And so you're doing this sort of like, okay, what could be contributing to this? And I suspect that their clinical course while they're in the hospital kind of leads you in a particular direction. In our clinical case that we started this podcast with, okay, pretty clear, came from exercise. I guess more interestingly though, her levels didn't really drop down as fast and as regularly as you would like expect, particularly 25 days later, she's still like pretty elevated. And if we assume that she's not actually exercising, I guess that could warrant some additional workup. Like, hey, do you have an underlying sort of autoimmune disease or like a sickle cell trait, for example? Yeah. What are you guys doing in the hospital to sort of come up with the like sort of root cause analysis, so to speak?
Yeah. I'm just, you know, listening to the person's story of what led them to come in and seeing if the preceding events seem proportionate with what I'm seeing on their labs and things like that. So if I saw somebody who said, I've never done a glute ham sit-up and I just did 60 of them with toes-to-bar and now I have a CK of 70,000, I say, yeah, I buy that. That's okay. That fits. That seems proportionate. I'm usually just going to like stop it there. I'll treat them. And if everything proceeds as I would expect, and sometimes people decrease a lot slower than I would like, but I still don't really bat an eye at that. That's actually quite common that they might decrease a little bit more slowly, but I just treat them until the end point. And if they get down as low as I would like, which our usual target is to get them down below about 5,000, and then we can usually stop IV fluids and let them go home, there's actually not really a need to even recheck CK levels beyond that. The scenarios where I would, you know, dig a lot further into the causes is if the story does not seem to proportionately explain what's going on. If they're like, oh, I did some, you know, I took a walk and now I'm coming in and my CK level's 20,000. It's like, okay, that is not proportionate. And so I need to dig a little bit further. Let me dig into, you know, what medicines you're on, what other medical conditions you have. Do you have any other signs or symptoms of like an autoimmune condition, genetics, you know, family history of this stuff, et cetera. So it really comes down to like proportionality is the first part. And then does your clinical course follow the trajectory that I expect it to? And an example of when it didn't is that woman that I talked about earlier, where I treated her. To be fair, she was a little bit disproportionate when she came in, but I said, I don't know, maybe her exertion was harder than she remembers. But then she just like her level stopped going down. And so I was like, okay, well, clearly there's some ongoing muscle injury going on and she had an autoimmune disease attacking her muscles. And so we figured that out. So those are probably the two ways that I go about that.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a number of maybe, I don't want to call them clinical practice guidelines, or just effectively consensus statements by various authors and groups that have effectively, they recapitulate exactly what you just said. If somebody gets rhabdomyolysis, exertional rhabdomyolysis after like a low intensity sort of effort, it's like, okay, need a workup. If they have abnormal signs that are like, huh, that's interesting, further workup, like before return to play, before discharge, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And there are no like real safe discharge criteria either. Yeah, you want to get this, the creatine kinase down to below 5,000, but these retrospective reviews of 30 and 41 cases respectively found discharge CK values ranging from 1,400 to 94,000 and 10 to 61,000. And you're like, can you imagine sending somebody home with a CK level of 94,000?
Absolutely not.
Like what, dude? Like,
I will admit I've discharged people before they got down below 5,000, but that's usually they're still in the 5,000 to 10,000 range. But yeah, so there's a lot of ways, you know, in practice that once you get a feel for this, you get some experience with it. There's even like a risk scoring tool called the McMahon score that we sometimes use to like evaluate people's risk for, you know, needing kidney, you know, having kidney related complications and things like that. And so there's a lot of behind the scenes decision making that goes on here. But whoever discharged that patient at 94,000 is a savage who probably should have been sued.
Wow. Right. As far as an evidence-based guideline on return to unrestricted activity, yeah, we don't really have that. There's been some proposed guidelines that was validated by a study in college football players, but to be fair, that sample size was only 10. So I don't know how confident I would feel in those guidelines, but they seem reasonable to me. It's basically this four-phase approach where phase one lasts a minimum of 72 hours, 3 days, and focuses on significant activity modification and early follow-up. So effectively, somebody get discharged from a hospital or if they're being managed outpatient because they didn't have acute kidney injury, effectively, they're told rest for 72 hours. Or you can perform light activity indoors, get 7 to 8 hours of sleep per night, drink plenty of fluids. And they also recommend increasing sodium intake through foods. So things like peanuts, nuts, pretzels, soy sauce, canned salmon, canned beans. I don't actually know what that's for. I assume they're just trying to make it like you're consuming a bunch of saline with all the extra salt from those things.
It may be because if they're recommending the person drink a ton of water to try to reduce the risk of them getting hyponatremic.
Yeah, dilution.
Yeah.
They say in this phase one, so again, the first sort of 72 hours, that resistance training should be avoided until phase two and then added progressively. So this progression of phase two is dependent on the outcome of repeat laboratory findings for CK and lack of clinical symptoms. So they're recommending sort of repeat CK test and urinalysis repeated 72 hours after the last known test. And if the results are less than 5 times the upper limit of normal, which would be like a level of 600 or 700, something like that, and the urinalysis continues to be normal, and the patient is symptom-free, then they can go into phase two. Now, phase two introduces light outdoor but no strenuous activities and lightweight resistance trainings. So it's like body weight stuff or 20 to 25% of 1RM exercises. They also recommend that these activities should, if possible, be supervised by a physical therapist or athletic trainer, to which I ask, why? What is a physical therapist or athletic trainer going to do?
I don't see a necessary role for them, particularly in all cases.
Yeah, I can tell by the way you have some knee valgus in your bodyweight squat that your CK level is high. Like, come on, guys. I feel like they just added that in there to make it sound nicer without actually thinking about it. To your common saying, it makes sense if you don't think about it. They also recommend that the athlete should follow up with the provider after 1 week and may progress to phase three if clinical symptoms are absent. And in phase three, the intensity of the exercise gets higher. Resistance training can be performed at 50 to 75% of one rep max. Agility drills at 70 to 80% of max effort. Don't know how they're rating that, but that's what they recommend. And running can begin at 50 to 75% of normal time and distance. I think that's all reasonable. It's all made up, to be clear, but it seems reasonable enough to me if you were looking for some sort of guidance here. And then finally, phase four returns the athlete to full physical training with follow-up as needed. This was the more interesting thing in these four phases, is that because muscle pain serves as a clinical guide for progression through the phases, that they recommend against pain relievers like Tylenol or NSAIDs so as not to mask pain, which was interesting because in our original case, she was sent home to take NSAIDs and drink water. And it's like, man, she could have been masking maybe some of this excessive muscular pain. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's actually a reasonable piece of advice. And I think anybody who just had bad rhabdo, especially if I'm discharging them from the hospital, I mean, using NSAIDs for the discomfort, given that all the concern here is around kidney stuff, and that's something that NSAIDs can impact. I mean, I think that just to be clear, that risk to the kidneys from long-term use of NSAIDs is, in general, I think, I don't want to say overblown, but people put a lot more concern into it, whereas they're actually relatively safe when used in reasonable dose ranges and things like that. But in the short term, when somebody has just experienced a bout of like potentially pretty kidney risking a medical event, I would say NSAIDs are absolutely would not be recommended to take. And I think that, you know, I agree that these guidelines are reasonable, even though they are made up. I agree that I don't think a athletic trainer or a PT needs to see everybody who just had rhabdo. I don't even think there's enough of those resources for such a thing. The time frame is also made up, but is fine. As a, you know, if it had said like progress, I don't know, 15% per week or something, we would have been like, yeah, sure, that's fine. Just the you don't want it to be too quick, doing too much too soon, because that's the same way you got into this sort of thing. And so to that end, I agree that like the use of these symptoms, as it says, use of muscle symptoms or pain, muscle pain, is a guide for progression. That's really one of the main things that I have a conversation about with people. I actually don't know where this idea comes from that you need to like continue serially checking CK levels in the subsequent weeks, particularly if you don't think that there was some undiagnosed underlying cause for the rhabdo. I don't know that I see a strong need for that. We saw that in the original case. The girl got her CK checked multiple more times, and I'm like, okay, I still don't care about it.
It's, 25 days later.
It doesn't matter, because the main focus, the risk of kidney injury is, very, very, very low at that point. So we don't need to be monitoring that so much as like, following the person's symptoms, just like we would in actually, I view this recovery from rhabdo similar to how we view rehab from anything else. If you've listened to our content on managing pain and injury, adjusting load and volume and all that stuff up front. And then if your symptoms are dramatically worse after a session, well, you've already gone too far and you definitely shouldn't do that after rhabdo. So pull it way back, and then your rate of progression should be moderated in accordance with these symptoms. They should not be worsened. You should not experience, significant increase in muscle soreness. And so that means that, yeah, I agree. The first, couple days afterwards, I'm telling people to, generally just like do their activities of daily living, but probably not return to training for a few days. And then once they do, like scale way back on the intensity. And that's usually a conversation based on what I usually ask, like, what does the person prefer to do for their training? Are they mainly a lifter? Are they, did they just like decide to pick something up? Was it running related, whatever the case is? And I'll just on the spot usually make up, just to give them some kind of concrete guidance instead of leaving them like nebulous advice, I'll make up and say, why don't we start, at this percentage of where you were before. Mm-hmm. And then on the fly, because I guess this is an advantage of being facile with exercise programming and the concepts around this, is I can kind of come up with a progression, a scheme for somebody over the subsequent. Usually it's over the matter of like weeks for most people, usually many weeks getting into like a couple, maybe like 6-8 weeks or something like that. Sometimes a bit longer if they've had a particularly severe bout, not usually too much faster than that. I don't set expectations that you'll be back to normal stuff in like 2 weeks. I think that's probably still a bit fast if you've required hospitalization for something like this. So yeah, that's usually the way the conversation goes that I have with folks.
Yeah. And we should reiterate that if you were following an intelligently programmed exercise, program, rhabdomyolysis is really not something to be concerned with. And in general, the causes of this are effectively doing stuff that's way outside of what you're prepared to do, plus or minus some environmental sort of risk factors, plus or minus some culture sort of effects here. The problem is that exertional rhabdomyolysis has put you into a hole. Effectively. So it's like, okay, now you're like recovered, but you're still not ready to jump into like unrestricted training. Not that an intelligent program wouldn't have been suitable for you before. It's just, well, you put yourself in this little recovery pit. And so we got to get you out of it. So if you wanted to do, all right, a quarter of what you were doing before at, a quarter of the intensity for the first week or two, that'd be fine. And then 50% of what you were doing before, 50% intensity, fine, 2 weeks. Now you're at 75%. Again, it's all made up. But yeah, I would expect that after about 2 months or so that somebody would be back to unrestricted training, but don't do the stupid thing you did before. That's the whole thing. Like if you see 60 glute ham developer sit-ups on a workout and you haven't prepared for that, just skip it. I promise the trophy isn't worth it. I promise the trophy isn't worth it.
Yeah, definitely not. Yeah, I mean, this is like the same fundamental concept when we're like people ask us, how do I reduce the risk of injury or something like that? And aside from outside the gym factors, like making sure you're adequately, you know, have adequate sleep and stuff like that. It's prepare for the thing you're trying to do and then do the thing you prepared for and like deviate from that minimally if you can, if you wanted to absolutely minimize the risk of injury. Now, we recognize, like, you know, the whole idea around CrossFit in particular, the unknown and unknowable. It's like defined by like being unprepared for things and being adapted to everything, which is a very challenging task, but it means you need a lot of preparation. That's why like games athletes are like exceptionally well prepared for all of the things that could be, that have been thrown at them, that could be thrown at them, etc. And for somebody who's not at that level, I think restricting yourself a bit more to, you know, doing the things that you're prepared for, and maybe a tiny bit more, but not deviating wildly in terms of volume or like the scope or type of activity is generally wise for people who don't want to increase the risk of injury in general or of rhabdo in particular.
Yeah. And in general, start slow, build up from there. But yeah, nobody is running like an auto-regulated, well-thought-out program and, oh, I got rhabdo, without some sort of underlying cause. Now, if it does happen, that requires medical workup, figure out what's going on, treat that to the best of our current, you know, available interventions. And then, you know, again, scale up over time back to unrestricted activity. But yeah, I think we sufficiently covered rhabdomyolysis, episode 266 of the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Thanks to Dr. Austin Brockett for joining me on this podcast. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.